We'll return now to the main focus of this hour, Medicaid and Medicare reform. The nation's governors meeting this week in Washington declined to endorse the president's proposals for reforming Medicaid, the health program for the poor. The proposed changes would provide states with greater flexibility in administering Medicaid, but the governors fear they might be left without enough money to fund the program a few years down the road. The governors say they need more details about the proposed reforms. Members of Congress are also seeking more information. Joining us now to sort through the complexities of Medicaid and Medicare is NPR's Julie Rovner. Julie, first, let's put these two programs in perspective. First of all, how much do these programs cost the government?
A whole lot. Medicare, I think last year, and these are last year's numbers, cost about $270 billion. Medicaid cost about $275 billion. That's total federal and state because it's a shared program. Together, they made up more than 20% of federal spending. That's just the federal share of Medicaid and all of Medicare. Medicaid covered about 45 million people last year. Medicare covered about 41 million people. So they're very large. Medicaid, for instance, covers one of every three deliveries of a baby in the country and covers one of every four children. So these are programs that are a big part of the federal budget, a big part of the health budget. We spent $1.4 trillion on health in 2001. And so you can see this is getting up towards a third of that.
And you mentioned that this is a shared program between the federal and state governments. If the federal government is spending so much money on Medicaid and Medicare, why has the program become such a financial burden for the states? Can you explain that?
Yes. Well, it's just Medicaid. Well, actually, it's not true. Both Medicare and Medicaid are a financial burden for the states. Medicaid is a financial burden because, obviously, Medicaid is a shared expense. The federal government pays roughly 55% of Medicaid cost. In a lot of states, it pays 50-50. State pays a dollar. The federal government pays a dollar. In poorer states, the federal government actually pays more. In some states, they pay as little as 20 cents. For every dollar the federal government puts in. Now, Medicaid, you have to understand, is the second largest piece of almost every state's budget. After education comes Medicaid in virtually every state. So it's very large. It's about 20% of most states' budgets, and it's growing at double-digit rates. That in itself makes a problem. Medicare enters into this also because Medicare doesn't pay for a lot of things. Medicare doesn't pay for outpatient prescription drugs. Medicare doesn't pay for most nursing home care. So what you have are 6 million people who are what we call dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. These are senior citizens who are on Medicare who are poor enough that they also qualify for Medicaid. So the states are basically filling in Medicare's gaps, and it's the coverage, it's mostly those prescription drugs and the long-term care costs that are going up so fast. So the fact that the federal Medicare program isn't delivering what it's supposed to, which is care for seniors, that's falling back on the states and hitting them in their Medicaid budgets.
All right, how is the president proposing to change Medicaid, first of all?
Well, we know a little bit more about what the president wants to do on Medicaid. Now, they want to take Medicaid is a terribly complicated program. There are mandatory populations and optional populations. There are people that the federal government, federal law says you must cover, people federal law says you can cover. Then there are benefits that the federal government says you must cover and benefits that the federal government says you can cover. So you have the mandatories and the optionals. What the federal government is proposing to do is take the optional benefits and the optional populations. So we're talking about one third of the beneficiaries, but we're talking about two-thirds of the Medicaid dollars. And what they want to do is give the states complete flexibility. Rather than saying you're going to take this optional population, you can do whatever you want. However, there's a catch. They're going to give them about $12 billion up front to help with their immediate budget needs, but they're going to make them basically pay that money back over in about 7 years. They're going to have to start paying it back. And in the end, there would be a cap on that optional spending. Right now, whatever the states opt to spend, the federal government will match. There's no limit. They would put a cap on it. There's a lot of questions still, and I think that's why the governors have been kind of hesitant.
Yeah, they're not ready to jump right in yet. All right, quickly, if you can, maybe summarize what some of the proposals are with regards to Medicare.
Well, that's quicker to summarize because we really don't know yet. Uh-huh. We've had some thoughts, and Tommy Thompson just this morning again was telling the Budget Committee that they hope to have their plan really soon. What we think is that the federal government wants to urge Medicare beneficiaries to join private plans. Now, they're saying they're not going to force anybody into HMOs, health maintenance organizations, but they're probably going to try to make more PPOs, less restrictive kinds of managed care plans, more widely available, and they're going to urge beneficiaries to join them. As a carrot, they'll probably offer prescription drugs through those private plans. The original version of the plan that got floated suggested that people who stay in Medicare's traditional fee-for-service, you can go to any doctor or hospital you want, they might not get prescription drug coverage. That didn't sell at all up here. Democrats, Republicans said, no way. So that sent the administration back to the drawing board. The problem the administration has is they set aside $400 billion over 10 years for this whole program. But if you're going to make the benefit available to everybody, it's going to cost a lot more than $400 billion. So they're having trouble kind of reconciling the money they want to spend with the benefit that they want to have.
And this all has huge political ramifications, doesn't it, Julie? And that's why everybody's reacting pretty skittishly, it seems to me, to these proposals.
Enormous. More so Medicare than Medicaid. The senior constituency is an important swing voting block. Both Democrats and Republicans want them badly. Everyone, Democrats, Republicans, every member of Congress basically ran the last two elections promising to provide a prescription drug benefit through Medicare. They haven't been able to deliver. President Bush desperately wants to deliver before he's back up for election. So this is a very high-stakes debate.
Sounds like, though, we're really just at the starting post.
And we are really just at the starting post. But they're vowing up here that they want to get something passed before the summer, before presidential politics kind of, you know, enters into this and makes it even harder.
I heard July 4th.
The House is saying Memorial Day. The Senate is saying the August recess. I think that's probably optimistic on both parts.
But you think this something is going to happen?
I certainly think they're going to try. I'm not sure I would say that something is going to happen. They've certainly tried the last two Congresses, and you know the House has passed a bill each of the last two Congresses. The Senate's had a lot more trouble. The budget is in a lot worse shape this time than it was the last two times, so it's going to be harder. And every year they don't do this, the number of Medicare beneficiaries goes up, and the cost of prescription drugs goes up, so the whole thing gets more expensive.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Lynn.
NPR's Julie Robner spoke to us from Capitol Hill. When we come back, we'll talk more about Medicaid and Medicare. Give us a call to join the discussion. Call 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the Bush administration's proposed changes to Medicaid and Medicare. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining me now here in Studio 3A, Ron Pollack, Executive Director of Families USA, which does not agree with the president's proposals. Thanks for being with us,
Delighted to be with you again.
And Merrill Matthews, who's a visiting scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation, and he's also the director at the Council for Affordable Health Insurance, and he thinks it's time for a change. Welcome to you also.
Good to be with you.
Let me start out with you, Ron Pollack. You are a healthcare advocate, but do you agree that Medicare and Medicaid need to be reformed now?
Well, there's no question there need to be some improvements in both programs. With respect to Medicaid, states are asking for more relief from the federal government because they feel they don't have the resources to pay for the Medicaid program, and so yes, the states are in need of additional money. There are proposals that are pending that would achieve that. I don't believe the administration's proposal achieves that. With respect to Medicare, it needs to be updated, and the most important way it could be updated is by adding a prescription drug benefit. Prescription drugs are an integral part of providing health care today, so it doesn't really make sense that Medicare covers hospital care and physician care, but doesn't cover prescription drugs.
Well, how would you propose to make some changes to it? I mean, what would you suggest?
Well, let's first start with what's problematical, if you don't mind, with what the administration
Sure.
is proposing. With respect to Medicaid, I think the best way I can describe it, it's really the public policy equivalent of loan sharking. In effect, what the administration is doing is it understands that the states are in fiscal trouble. So they're giving a very small amount of money up front, sort of like a loan, and then later on, they not only recapture that money, but they actually give to the states much less money than they would receive under current law. And as Julie properly said, they place a cap in the nature of a block grant, similar to what Newt Gingrich tried to do in 1995. Now, what does that mean? It means that the states, which are struggling to provide health coverage for people who very much need it, when unemployment goes up, the economy's in worse shape, when the number of uninsured has increased, if you give a rigid block grant amount of money to the states, they can't respond to that crisis. Moreover, they're going to receive less money, even in a period when it's not a crisis, than they receive today. And so as a result, what we're going to see is we're going to see people who are currently on Medicaid cut from the program. We're going to see benefits slashed for people who are on the program. And people on the program are going to be paying more in premiums, deductibles, and out-of-pocket costs because the states simply will not have the capacity to pay for this. I think there's a better way to do this because you asked me what would I suggest. What I would suggest instead is what the United States Senate has already adopted by a huge margin in a bipartisan vote. What the Senate did was they adopted a proposal proposed by Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, and Jay Rockefeller, Democrat from West Virginia, that provided more federal matching dollars to the states so that the states would have a greater capacity to serve the people they are trying to serve today. Now, Medicare's a
Well, I was going to say it's completely different. Let's just since we're on Medicaid and the details thereof at the moment, let me turn to you, Merrill Matthews, and just get your take on the president's proposals regarding reform of Medicaid and the proposal that the governors were looking at this week and didn't seem to be happy with because they're concerned about where the money's going to be down the road.
They're governors and they're concerned about unfunded mandates. That is, the Washington saying we want you to do this and providing part of the funds. On the other hand, it's partly a governor who's driving this. In fact, you could say two governors. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, is a governor who started welfare reform in Wisconsin back in the 80s, experimented with welfare reform in several different ways, finally found a model he thought was working, and Wisconsin became something of a model for welfare reform. We saw people going back to work. We saw the welfare rolls declining. We saw the state saving some money. Some of that was due to a good economy. Some of it was due to restructuring the welfare program. Tommy Thompson believes that governors have the ability to look out over this. You got 50 different governors looking at different plans, different populations, and he wants to try to give them the incentive to do what in Medicaid, what he did in welfare, which is look for various kinds of options, ways to move perhaps people in the private sector, other ways to run the program. And so part of the administration is just simply trying to give the governors more of an incentive to move into kind of a Tommy Thompson model.
Would you say that what we're looking at here, you mentioned welfare reform, I mean, is this like welfare reform? Is it that kind of a shift in thinking that's going on?
It is something of a shift in thinking. It's like welfare reform in that there was concern that within the general welfare population, the people who deal with welfare issues, that these programs get going, they sort of get a life of their own, they keep growing, people get into them, never get out, and it creates sort of a welfare class. What they want to try to do with Medicaid is find a way to meet the health insurance needs of low-income Americans, but do it in a way that doesn't necessarily expand a federal program. Now, there's ways you can do that, and one of the things they're doing is looking at letting people move into private sector health insurance options. There's a number of ways that could be done. As you pointed out, the administration has not been terribly specific about what it wants to do there. To some extent, they want to give the governors the chance to become creative.
Is that on Medicaid as well, that they would be looking at shifting people into private?
Absolutely. If you look at Tommy Thompson's press statement and if you followed his announcement on this, what's it been, about 3 weeks ago, they want to give Medicaid, state Medicaid systems, the ability to move people into private sector insurance, for instance. If you have, within the Medicaid population, you have a lot of people on long-term care and nursing homes, that doesn't work terribly well for this. But there's a number of people who use Medicaid simply for insurance. Medicaid insurance is a very rich package. It is much richer than many employees have out there. So they're looking at ways that you might be able to give people options to move into private sector health insurance plans, HMOs, PPOs, that's what most people are in these days, Medicaid, medical savings accounts, range of different options, and just to see what the states can come up with.
Ron?
Yeah, Lynn, I think there are a couple of points that need to be made. First of all, we're not talking about a welfare population here. We're talking about working families. Of the folks who are uninsured in America, 4 out of 5 are in working families. And in Medicaid covers working families where you can't get health coverage through the workplace, where an employer has not provided the opportunity to get health coverage. So I think the analogy to welfare reform is a little strained. But I think the most important point here is that what this is going to do to the governors is it will, in effect, give them less flexibility. And the reason it gives them less flexibility is they're going to have less money, and they're going to get the exact same amount of money, irrespective whether times are good or times are bad, whether the economy is causing more people to be uninsured. And so the states won't have the capacity to serve the people who really need the Medicaid program.
All right, we're talking about Medicaid and Medicare reform on Talk of the Nation. The number here is 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a call from Ron in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'd like to address that. The big thing is that Medicare and Medicaid are just, I think, victims of the same cost spiral that you're seeing in the whole general health care system. For example, last time they tried any type of real reform, the health care system, 1994, I believe the amount of money spent was $800 billion. I believe that's up to $1.4 trillion. Just 9 years, that's 75% increase. I think I read somewhere there's like been a cut in real constant dollars since the Reagan years in Medicaid, for example, of about 40 or 50% as far as what they would be spending if they had maintained spending levels at that time period. Yet the prices are still skyrocketing because of the general pricing structure in healthcare in general. And if they do not change that, if they don't do something to contain costs, you got a choice of either bankrupting the states and ultimately the government and a lot of small businesses, or in cutting services to the point where people are really going to suffer. Now, I know a lot of people. I do advocacy work for disability people. And a lot of people are receiving Medicaid are already suffering badly in that they're closing clinics that were Medicaid funded. These are from the modest reforms of the 90s. With some of the reforms that they're proposing here, there's going to be a lot of people, quite frankly, suffering miserably and dying if they don't stop this idea that somehow or another, it's almost like they're blaming the victims. And rather than doing something about pricing overall in healthcare, whether it means regulating the prices directly or doing something to stop this spiraling out of control pricing for overall healthcare.
Well, you know, I have to say.
Thanks for that call, Ron. I'm going to let our guests respond.
Yeah, I have to say that Ron is absolutely right. I have to say, at Families USA, we've experienced premium increases over the last 2 years at 24% and 26% respectively. So Ron is right in saying that Medicaid and Medicare can't be looked at in isolation. Healthcare costs generally across the country are rising very quickly. And what's interesting is if you look at the Medicare program, Medicare has actually kept costs down below what is being experienced in the private sector. And Medicaid is also undertaking a variety of innovative ways of trying to get costs down, especially in the area of prescription drugs. So you can't just take these programs in isolation and say, let's cut them, when healthcare costs throughout the nation are increasing so fast.
Ron is wrong in this aspect, in that Medicare already has price controls. Back in the 80s, the federal government created what we call the DRG system, which imposed price controls on hospitals. In the early 90s, they created a system called RBRVS, which imposed price controls on doctors. Both doctors and hospitals have a price control system now, and healthcare spending is still exploding. And as a result, because the federal government has been ratcheting back on its reimbursement rates, HMOs that decided to step in to help seniors with Medicare, nearly 2 million seniors lost part or all of their coverage under the Medicare HMOs because of the government cutting back on its reimbursement rates. I think just in the last few days, Congress decided to go ahead and stop some planned cuts for doctors in reimbursement rates. They had gone down 5.4% last year. They were going to go down 4.4% this year. Doctors are leaving the system because they say they simply can't make it under the reimbursement rates now. There are price controls.
Isn't this whole question of cost what's really driving this reform right now? I mean, isn't this why is it coming up now? Why is it so important?
Well, the federal government is trying to, you know, under the Bush administration, is trying to cap the amounts of money it spends, and in effect, it's shifting the burden to the states. When the federal government provides less money to the states or provides it in an inflexible block grant, it means that the states have got a Hobson's choice. Either they're going to pick up those additional costs on their own, and many states simply can't afford to do it, or they're going to cut back in terms of reducing eligibility, benefits, and requiring higher costs for beneficiaries. So what this really is the federal government is taking care of itself under the Bush administration by limiting how much it contributes to the program, but the states are going to be left holding the bag, and the people who ultimately will be hurt will be the people who depend on Medicaid as their health lifeline.
Well, let's just take Medicare for an example. The Medicare trustees say that by the year 2015, we will be spending more on Medicare than we're taking in the payroll tax that now pays for what we call Part A. The trustees say that by, I think, 75 years out, 40 years out, something like that, we're going to have to either cut Medicare, cut the services by 30% or increase taxes by 60% or some combination of the two. That's the Medicare trustees. The point is that the current system, as it's structured, is unsustainable financially. We have to do something. There may be different options out there, but it's unsustainable the way it's based right now.
We're talking about Medicaid and Medicare reform. The number here is 1-800-989-8255. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I have an email here that's really interesting. I'm not sure that you two can answer the question, but it's a great example of what people are going through and the problems people are confronted with in terms of health care. This is from a man named William Hall. He says, this is a straightforward question. I am awaiting a liver transplant, and I am on SSI and Medicaid. The cost for the operation is astronomical. The follow-up drugs could be $1,000 a month. Would you please tell me how the upcoming changes could affect me, especially since this operation is the only way to save my life?
Well,
Ron Pollack.
Well, it for somebody on Medicaid, I have to underscore, prescription drugs is one of these so-called optional services that Julie talked about earlier. And as the states consider what they're going to do when they don't get the relief that they're seeking from the federal government, they're going to be cutting some of these services. Now, what does that mean? It may mean that a state is going to say, we're only going to cover the first $150 or $200 in prescription drugs, or we'll cover two or three prescriptions per month. Those are the kinds of things I think we're going to see, and we're going to see a lot of people who before were eligible or currently are eligible for Medicaid who are just going to be dropped from the program altogether.
What about the cost of a liver transplant? Is it possible that a state could say, sorry, we can't cover that with Medicaid?
Well, you actually have in Oregon. Oregon has created an explicitly rationed system. Now, they've had some struggle going back and forth with it and the federal government. But they basically, when they started this system, they listed out what could be done, the various types of procedures, and ranked them in priority of what they felt like were the most important, put this out to public debate for a couple of years, and decided that they would go with this ration system and that they would check how much money they had funding for in each given year, decide where on the line, it was like 530 different procedures, where on the line they would cut, and then they would cut that and cover those above. But the point is that under any federal system, under any government system, there is never enough money to go around. There is no system in the world that is run by healthcare system run by the government where there's enough money simply because you always have other demands on money for education, defense, Social Security, welfare. There's never enough money to go around to cover these systems, so they all ration.
Listen, Merrill, when it's very interesting you focus on the government. We're experiencing huge cutbacks in the private sector today. Employers are saying they simply can't afford to sustain these fast increasing costs, and so some employers are dropping coverage. Others are passing on those costs to their workers. This is not a public sector phenomenon, as the earlier caller said. This is part of healthcare costs rising very rapidly throughout the country, and Medicare and Medicaid, frankly, have done a better job in terms of keeping costs down than the private sector has. And so, thankfully, the Medicare program is providing coverage for 41 million beneficiaries today at a price that makes it affordable for seniors to get it who couldn't get it before the Medicare program was implemented.
Let me just briefly go back to this email. If you could just, Merrill Matthews, if you could just quickly, the changes that are being proposed, which would give states more flexibility in terms of Medicaid, does that mean one state possibly could say, will do the liver transplant, another state might say, we can't cover it?
I certainly think a state might try to do that. You may also have the federal government then step in and restrict those kinds of changes based upon discrimination or something else, which has been happening in Oregon because they were going to cut some of the funding for, as I recall, HIV and AIDS care or something, and then so the federal government said, we're not sure we want to let you do that. It seems like discrimination. But I suppose it's feasible that could happen. I would be surprised if it will.
All right. We're talking about challenges Medicaid and Medicare face right now. When we come back from our break, I want to get a little more into Medicare. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about the future of Medicare. How can it sustain our aging society and survive budget shortfalls? Join us at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests here in Studio 3A, Ron Pollack is the Executive Director of Families USA, and Merrill Matthews is the Director of Council for Affordable Health Insurance. Let's turn our attention, our focus to Medicare right now, because the President's proposals, and now as I understand it, we don't have the details, but philosophically, there seems to be a shift going on to encourage people to leave Medicare and get their benefits through managed care. Ron, what's wrong with that?
Well, what this does is it forces seniors to make a choice. Either they choose to get the drugs they so desperately need, or they want to retain the doctors they have depended on for many years. In effect, what the Bush administration is doing is they're saying, if you want to get prescription drugs, you've got to leave the traditional Medicare program that 87% of America's seniors have chosen to be in, and you have to go into an HMO or other managed care plan in order to get prescription drugs. So this is going to force seniors into a Hobson's choice. Now, mind you, what's problematical about this is that these private plans, these HMOs and managed care plans, have not served the Medicare population well at all. For example, these programs do not serve people in rural communities. 80% of rural Medicare beneficiaries do not have access to a private managed care plan. So that's a problem if they're being forced into such a plan as the way to get prescription drugs. In addition to that, in those communities where HMOs and managed care plans have served seniors, many of them have dropped those communities. There are 2.4 million seniors who used to be in these plans, and they were dropped when the HMO left the community. And lastly, when in those areas where these private plans remain in existence, they're increasing the cost, they're increasing premiums, they're increasing copayments, and they're decreasing services. So what the president is trying to do is push people into very unpopular plans that have not served the senior population well.
Merrill?
Well, what the president is trying to do is he has looked at the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, the program that provides health insurance for roughly 8.3 million federal workers, retirees, and their dependents. And he's trying to create a system that would work something like that for seniors. We actually tried to do that back in 1995 when Congress passed Medicare Plus Choice. Didn't actually pass till 1997. It was meant to do precisely that. That is, give seniors the choice of a Medicare PPO, Medicare HMO, Medicare Medical Savings Account, a fee-for-service plan under Medicare. As it turns out, no one really wanted to come play in that game except the Medicare HMOs that were already serving the population out there. I think Ron's being a little bit disingenuous when he talks about the Medicare HMOs dropping out. Congress made an explicit decision to cut reimbursement rates for them. They had people saying, we can afford it, and they dropped.
I want to get some calls in here. Catherine in Costa Mesa, California. Hello, Catherine. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I wanted to agree with Ron what he was just saying about the HMOs not serving the seniors. Here's another interesting point that affects all seniors. It has to do with their drug benefit that comes when they go to these HMOs. They generally push generics or older medicines first. And the fact of the matter is we have lots of new medications that are out that actually have been shown to decrease morbidity and mortality, and it is a lot less expensive to intervene pharmaceutically than it is to wait for an event to happen. Unfortunately, these HMOs do take these seniors on, take them off the drugs that are the ones that are going to keep them out of the hospital. And when asked why are they like that, why are they doing that to these people, you find out basically the insurance companies are really only in it for about a 1 or 2 year shot. They want to make as much money as possible, and then they pull out. And to the second guest point about they're not dropping out, yes, indeed, they are dropping out. I'm here in California, and I can name a couple of different communities where the HMOs have just absolutely left, and there is no coverage other than fee-for-service. And then, again, these patients who are trying to get a formulary benefit have absolutely lost it. Lancaster, California is an excellent example.
Catherine, I didn't say that the HMOs weren't leaving. I said they were leaving, but the reason they were leaving is because Congress decided to cut back the reimbursement rates that they're paying them. My guess is if Congress paid them more, they could look at some brand-name drugs and other things, but the reimbursement rates are getting fairly low for them.
Mayor, I have to disagree with that. Every year over the last years, Congress has increased the amount of money that HMOs are receiving, that managed care plans are receiving, and indeed, we've now seen reports from the General Accounting Office and the Inspector General that have been saying as clearly as they could that these private HMOs and managed care plans are receiving too much money. It is not the problem that they're getting less and less. They're getting more and more, but yet they feel that their profit margins are not high enough, and therefore they're abandoning these communities.
Look in the books. I would like to know, how does a company like WellPoint Financial Services, which is basically Blue Cross, cook their books so that they can show that their insurance end is losing money, but yet they're able to help people make lots and lots of money on monies that they're investing? Isn't that the way insurance was supposed to always work? They took the money up front, they invested it, made more money on it, and then also used extra to help cover people. Well, but in the meantime, they're making money on the cash flow.
Okay. All right, thanks for your call, Catherine.
We're cooking the books.
All right, I'm going to let our guest respond.
Well, Catherine, I think most health insurance companies actually have sort of a pay-as-you-go. That's not exactly the right term, but the money comes in from the premiums, which goes out fairly quickly. Most of them have they have reserves, which is they have a pot of money, but the money is coming through and going back out to pay the health insurance premiums. I have to tell you, not being an HMO, I don't know whether they're making money or not, but my sense is when the HMOs say, we can't make money on this, we're pulling out of the system, you have to take them for their word for it. They want to sell the policies. They want to be able to keep people in there if they feel like they're making the money to do it.
All right, let's take another call from Rick in Los Angeles, California. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I'm a practicing family physician in California, and what I'm not enjoying hearing is all the double talk here between both callers and these two gentlemen. Basically, it's everybody's problem. We've got a huge mess here. And it's not just HMOs or the government. It's that the whole system needs to be restructured. And as a practicing doctor who takes both Medicare, cash, you know, fee-for-service, Medicaid, HMO, everybody is trying hard to control costs. Even the HMOs are. You wouldn't believe how much information I get from them about how to take care of people, what drugs to use. And, you know, name-brand drugs are being used. They're not all generic. It's just how you contract for the drugs. And, you know, and it turns out that some of the old generics are probably better at saving lives, like hydrochlorothiazide, than we once thought, if you read the papers in the literature. So, you know, it's a huge mess. We have got to restructure the whole environment. You can't pay doctors who do procedures like epidurals $3,000 for back pain that only lasts 2 months and pay your family doctor $45. And if I bill Medicaid, I get $17, and it costs me and my office $29 to see that patient. It can't go on this way. No matter how you structure it with what you're talking about, with Bush's plan, it's not going to work. Eventually, it's going to collapse.
Rick, a lot of doctors, or some doctors anyway, are beginning not to take Medicare patients. But you still are?
We take everybody. We try to give people free medicine. I have senior patients who can't afford to eat or buy drugs. And so what happens is when I tell them to take something twice a day, they take it every other day because they can't afford the food on their table. You know, this is so terrible what I see on a day-in, day-out basis. I don't know what to do. I'm pulling my hair out. I wish the government and the president would talk to doctors who are like me, practicing in the community, because I think we have better ideas about how we can deal with this.
Can you do me a favor and just, can you go over the what you said before? You went over it fast, and I just want to hear it. The difference in what you would get from Medicaid, Medicare, and a private patient for one procedure?
Okay. If a patient comes in and talks to me about, let's say, depression, I might bill $50, and I'll get $27 from Medicare and $17 from Medicaid. I am actually paying that patient to come and see me. If my colleague down the street who's treating back pain wants to do a set of epidurals, he will bill $2,000 to $3,000 for a 10-minute procedure three different times. So basically, the back pain is treated, and we know we can't cure that, and it may only last a certain length of time. People in Oregon have actually said you can't treat back pain in the office because we know you can't do much about it anyway. Especially if the patient is, you know, has a chronic problem. It's a very difficult issue to deal with how we're paid. Proceduralists, as much as I do rely on my colleagues who are surgeons and who do interventions like that, you know, you can't throw money that way if it's not going to be effective in the end.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Rick.
Thank you.
We're discussing Medicaid and Medicare reform, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I wonder if either of our guests would want to respond to
that.
Well,
I think Rick is absolutely right. We need to rethink and restructure the health care system. The health care system is in a mess, and it's largely a function of the way we end up doing the health care system. We have an employer-based system. There are benefits with the employer-based system, but people lose their health insurance when they change jobs. The employer decides on what kind of health insurance policy you have, which employees may or may not want. The government spends nearly half of all health care dollars in the country. As a result, the government ends up setting the prices on these things, and some doctors get very well paid under it. Many doctors don't get well paid. It is, as Rick says, it's a mess, and it needs to be completely restructured. But doing that's a grand political item that I don't think is going to be on the Bush administration.
Well, we've tried to restructure health care, and it didn't work very well, did it?
That's right. Lynn, there is a practical answer here that, while it's not a restructuring of the entire healthcare system, that would help both Medicare beneficiaries and states dealing with the Medicaid program. And the most important thing that could be done is by adding a prescription drug benefit to the Medicare program. What that would do is, for Rick's patients who have to choose between eating or purchasing drugs, it would provide them with some meaningful relief so that they could get the drugs that they need. It would also help the Medicaid program, because Medicaid picks up the slack for the lowest income seniors who don't have drug coverage, and so it would provide fiscal relief to the states so that they can strengthen their Medicaid programs for all the remaining population.
Let me just throw out, we have an email here. This comes up frequently in these kinds of discussions, and goes right to the larger reform of the whole healthcare system. Frankly, we're missing the whole picture. In this country, we're forking out 14.25% of GNP on healthcare. Canada spends 9% of its GNP and covers everyone. We have 41 million uninsured. What is so hard about implementing the Canadian system here? There would be plenty of money if we saved as much as Canada does.
I want to make sure that we focused. That's a wonderful question, because we are the only country in the Western world that doesn't serve all of our population and make sure they have health care coverage, and we have by far the most expensive cost. There's something different between saying we want to get coverage for everyone and then saying we've got to do it the Canadian way. There are lots of different ways to make sure that we get coverage for everybody. And I have to tell you that if you take a look at the total number of people who are affected by being uninsured, it's even larger than the 41 million. So, yes, we've got to restructure America's healthcare system so that everyone has access to affordable, high-quality care.
Lynn, yeah. Back in June, I was on a bus going from Canada to the United States, taking patients from Canada who couldn't get the care they needed in Canada to come to the United States. Wrote about it at the Wall Street Journal on July 5th. There were people there who needed technology, prescription drugs, family doctors, a whole range of things. Anybody who looks at the Canadian press will find that they have numerous problems there. We don't want their problems.
Okay. Ron, we're going to have to stop now. We're at the starting post of this debate. I can feel it in this room right now. It's going to go on for a lot longer. And thank you to both of you for
coming into this discussion.
Ron Pollack is the Executive Director of Families USA, and Merrill Matthews is the Director of the Council for Affordable Health Insurance. In Washington, I'm Lynn Neary, NPR News.